Hi, everybody. How are you today? This is Mark Chaffardini with the Go See Talk podcast experience. Thanks for coming back to the show, man. I hope 2022 has been everything you wanted. We're getting back into the danger zone. We had a new Batman movie, and we are excited to speak to a great friend of the site, Joe Trapanese. All Joe, no quit is the name of this podcast. Joey. Thank you for coming back. How's things in your world?
Things are good. I'm a huge Mets fan. So, you know, the last time we won the World Series was 1986. You know, Top Gun is here. You know, that came out in 1986. The original Kate Bush is on the charts. The Mets are looking good. So, hey, man, there are worse things than for it to be 1986 again. I'll take it. So.
You know, it's funny. It does feel like we're in a time warp. I was just yesterday. I spoke to a director named Greg Bjorkman, who directed Press Play, which is a time travel movie that uses cassette mixtape as a means of traveling through time. So, you know, records are back in vogue. I mean, I think we're a couple days away from Hammer Pants, you know, being sold at the Gap. But man, well, let's go back in time a little bit. I know the last time we talked, we got your whole backstory, but let's learn a little bit more about little Joey in New Jersey growing up. What were some of the things that you liked to watch and you know, you and your friends did?
You know, I was pretty basic. You know, I'm not going to sit here and pretend I was some whiz kid from an early age. I was always in like the advanced classes, but for math and physics and whatnot, I was never like the musical prodigy. Music was like just kind of the thing I did to hang out with my friends. You know, I had friends in the band, and so I played trombone in the band, and I'd taken some piano lessons when I was little, but I kind of quit thinking, oh, I'm going to be an engineer. And then I really fell in love with film music, you know, because of that, I joined a youth orchestra, and my friends were in that youth orchestra. It was this kind of dual purpose, like, you know, I get to hang out with my friends on the weekend in the youth orchestra and bands, that sort of thing. And music just kind of slowly took everything over. And I just started making music. A lot of it had to do with, you know, my teacher in middle school gave me a music program called Encore to play with, which, I mean, I doubt anyone on this podcast knows what Encore is, but it was like one of the earliest music notation software programs, but that also had a playback system. So like it was part sequencer too. So I would like write music in this system. I worked a whole summer in Liberty State Park in Jersey City, selling hot dogs and cotton candy and lemonades and ices, Italian ices to tourists to save up for my first synthesizer, which is actually still in the room back there. I used it on something called Jean-Claude Van Johnson. It was a Roland JV-1010, classic like mid-late 90s Roland synth. And when it came time to do Jean-Claude Van Johnson back in like 2016, 2017, you know, to me, like that is the 90s sound. You watch Kickboxer, you know, it wasn't really 80s. Like it was later than 80s. It was like getting into the 90s, more digital, synths and more advanced digital synths. So I actually built myself like this 90s digital synth rack, and that was the centerpiece. But I also had like some Proteus modules. It was a lot of fun. It was perhaps too much fun, and that series only lasted one season, which I think that was the plan, although Amazon made a big hullabaloo about we're not renewing this. And I think the director and the writer and I were looking at each other like that's the point, that this was this crazy once in a lifetime Jean-Claude Van Johnson. Anyway, sorry, now that we've gone into crazy tangents, what else can we talk about?
Well, you know, one of the most important things that I think about electronic music is it literally is like infinite and nebulous, and it's like tough to find your way. I mean, imagine with a piano or a guitar, you know, you have some basis in math, but I think when it comes to electronic music, how do you get lost and how do you find a direction? How do you, you know, like, how do you find you?
The point is not to get lost, hopefully, you know, is that obviously you can, and that is interesting. I lament all the time. I joke with friends, and I don't actually lament this, but it's more of a joke, but I think of, you know, John Williams sitting down with his 8-staff sketch paper, writes a cue, hands it to the orchestrator. You know, he walks into the scoring session, they put up the reel-to-reel tape, he lifts the baton, conducts the cues, and then goes to the beach, you know, he's done. Whereas with modern production, you know, I think for like this documentary series I did called America the Beautiful, you know, one of the things I tried to do was really represent all sorts of cultures of America. So I had a bluesman. I had amazing American Indians who like from the Chippewa, and I had an amazing folk singer. I had a violinist. I had an amazing diverse choir from LA called Tonality. But the recording process was so fractured because we were going out and recording these elements, and like putting it together was such a laborious but wonderful, rewarding process. So I guess to answer that question, the whole point is, you know, I worked with those specific artists because the story led me there. You know, we were telling a story about these great landscapes of America and the peoples and the creatures of America. So I said, I want to connect with some amazing musicians who represent deeply American cultures. And I think when you talk about something like Spiderhead, for instance, you know, I started that with a very limited palette, going, okay, I want to use human voices. I want to use cellos. I want to use clarinets, and I want to use electronics, but only certain kinds of electronics. So yeah, synths are infinite, but if you have specific ideas of what you want to do with it, as well as how you're engaging the story with it, that's how you prevent from getting lost. And so you go down its own rabbit hole, but you have what I like to say, like bumpers on the, you know, on the gutters. You know, you're not just going to roll the bowling ball away and it's going to go careen. You know, you're still going to get to the bowling pins somehow, you know, so you put up your gutters of trying to keep yourself on target. But yeah, you're right. Electronics, you could get completely, completely lost. And that was one of the big mistakes I made when I was younger. I'd try to do everything at once. It'd take me a week to write a piece of music. Whereas, you know, if I took a week to write every piece of music I write now, I wouldn't be able to do the work I do. So luckily I found a way that works for me where I really control and limit the template, the amount of sounds I work with. And I divide up the labor in terms of there are days and times where I make sounds, and there are days and times where I'm writing music, you know, and obviously they do cross-pollinate, but I try to have clear established boundaries that I could work within so I could actually deliver music.
Excellent. You know, that kind of reminds me of, I remember hearing J.J. Abrams talk about when he was charged to come up with Lost. And I think that the directive was, hey, write a kick-ass show. And he was like, okay, that's very like, you know, big canvas. And someone's like, okay, how about you make it on an island? Okay, now we're going to dial in. Now we can go somewhere. It's because you know what your limits are. But, you know, actually, I'm really glad we're talking about Spiderhead. And it's a really phenomenal score. And I know it means a lot to you. And you mentioned cellos earlier. And one of my questions was like, yes, cellos do a lot of the heavy lifting, especially like in the Darkened Flocks tracks or anything that involves that. So what besides that was important to you? And you also said keeping it, it felt like chamber music in a way. So what went into like this, you know, crafting this palette?
That's exactly right. I think chamber music is a great way to talk about it. I really wanted to limit the palette, limit the amount of musicians. You know, there's this great story about, Hitchcock, you know, hiring Bernard Herrmann or talking to Bernard Herrmann about, Rowboat, or it's a, I forget the name of the film. It all takes place in the ocean in a boat. And, you know, he's going, oh, I don't know, you know, Bernie, I don't know, where's the orchestra in the ocean? And he, his great response is, well, where's the camera? You know, so there's always a bit of magic in terms of filmmaking, but I think here, like the space, the limited space we operated in, the Spiderhead led me to the place where I wanted the music to feel really intimate, to feel like this is music that can happen present with the characters. I'll never forget having a conversation early on Oblivion with, you know, someone associated with the project who said, oh yeah, you know, Joe, you're just going to work with M83. He's going to do some electronics and you'll just put some strings on it. And I'm thinking like, have you seen the test footage of like Tom Cruise climbing a mountain? Like, I'm sorry, like we're going to need like a 90 piece orchestra and choir and like, you know, massive production. And that's what wound up happening is we had the whole shebang. So this is like, not necessarily the opposite, but just another instance of the film, the story, the characters determining where we're going with the music. So chamber music, intimate, I wanted to hear the musicians. And I made a lot of notes on this one. There, sometimes you get to a film score where, you know, you place the orchestra in a room, you set the mic levels, you record it, and that's it. this one was every cue or every kind of mood of music. I had really big notes from my engineer and worked with him very closely of like how much of the close mics should we use versus the ambient mics. So like, you know, on certain cues, I wanted distance on the choir. I wanted the choir to feel wide and big. And other cues, I wanted the choir to feel like just an assortment of individual voices that were really controlled. And I wanted to hear the individuality of the singers. So, you know, this was an interesting, I hesitate to use this word, this term, but like the anti-John Williams score where, you know, like John Williams lifts the baton and the orchestra plays and it's amazing and done. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's so cool. I want to do that someday. But just the idea of like, no, this was a score where like family to family of cues had a very different kind of lineup / production style. It wasn't completely made up on the fly. There were reasons I made these decisions, but like those clarinets you hear, like those, that choir of bass clarinets playing, where I actually in the score and in conversations with my engineers, like wrote out like which clarinet player would sit where so that we can control the panning, so that I knew that, you know, if I had this counterpoint going and I wanted it really wide, I could give it to the players sitting on either side of the hall that we were recording in. And so in your headset, in your headphones, or in the theater, you hear these like dueling bass clarinets happening, which, you know, like, does it make any difference? Hopefully it does. It sure does to me while I'm writing it. And I think the score came out really, really special because of all those little minuscule decisions I was making.
Well, I'm so glad you said that, because sometimes I try to listen to a score ahead of the film, and you know, barring something like The Phantom Menace, which gives a really big spoiler away, most of the time it gives you like an understanding of who these characters are. And I feel like I gravitate to the movie more once I feel the heartbeat after listening to the music. So all that said, sometimes I dive too deep into something. So I have to ask you, there's a track called Drip On, and it sounds a lot like you're saying that everything feels so distant, like you said. So was that specifically the track you're talking about? Because I thought I was imagining.
That's exactly right. Okay. No, that's exactly right. In fact, that's one of the few tracks that has violins on it. I had one session with a section of violins, and I put them as far back in the hall as I could put them. So like, you know, when we're recording, generally like the main array of microphones is across the front of the recording studio, kind of in front of the orchestra, and the main microphone set of that set is called the tree. It's this LCR trio of microphones that's usually right above the conductor generally. And so, you know, if I'm looking to create space, you know, I oftentimes try to think like a cinematographer. You know, am I zoomed all the way in? And in the case of the clarinets, they were sitting right up on the podium where the conductor is. So like, we're kind of zoomed in on the clarinets. The violins, it was the exact opposite. They were as far back away from the microphones. Obviously a non-traditional setup. Usually the orchestra, the violins are right in the front playing the big melodies. You hear them really clearly. I wanted the violins to feel foggy, kind of like our characters when they are under, you know, not to be too obvious, but Drip On is when, you know, they get the drugs put into them, and some of the drugs make you feel a little foggy, a little distant, a little, you know, so that's obviously a very clear analogy for that. And I'm as cool that you picked up on it. So it's working. Okay. What I'm doing is actually working.
Well, Joe, you have the tools, you have the talent, and you are just continuing to this career trajectory. But this is the third time you've worked with Joseph Kosinski. And I have to ask first off, Joe got his chance to do a Top Gun movie. Yet it didn't seem like we had the same track list that, you know, made the 86 movie so popular. So did he go license music crazy on this one? And did you have to work through, you know, needle drops to make a splash?
Believe it or not, this is my fourth film with Joe Kosinski, which is amazing to think. I started working with him in 2009 with Daft Punk on Tron Legacy.
That's right,
you know, it really is just amazing to think of the history we've had together. And we've developed this shorthand, which I think enables us to work with songs like we did on Spiderhead. I think any other filmmaker I haven't worked with before, with them that amount of songs, I'd be a little nervous, because like, you know, how do you blend song and score? There are parts of the film where we have three, four pieces of music overlapping, especially in some of the sequences involving Jeff's past, there's two songs bleeding into each other. There's two types of score bleeding into each other. There's a part where, you know, Jeff cranks up the radio and the song goes away and the score gets louder, you know? So, you know, because it was Joe, I know that everything he does has such a phenomenal design to it. And he's very sound driven. Like, he's not going to leave any stone unturned. So a lot of our meetings, a lot of our production meetings during the scoring process was about these exact moments. And all a big shout out to Stephen Mirioni, the editor, and Brian Lawson, my music editor, for how hard they worked to service us to make these moments actually work. Because at a certain point, you know, I'm busy kind of creating cool musical ideas. At a certain point, I have to have confidence in my music editor to work with the film editor to like work through these crazy moments so that when it comes back to me to work on, like there's like some kind of direction going, you know, based on obviously what Kaczynski is wanting. So definitely not an easy thing to handle, but I knew that because of Kaczynski's background, and luckily the songs were mostly written in the script. I think like something like 78 to 80% of the songs that you hear in the final cut of the film were written into the script. Obviously sometimes something's written in that you can't license, or, you know, you can't get that specific song, or it's five times more expensive than the budget or something. So obviously some of the songs changed, but for the most part, that was all in there from the beginning. So we kind of all knew what we were in for and had planned appropriately.
Okay. Okay. Well, I mean, that's really great to hear, because I know that, you know, watching the movie again, there are basically four source material tracks. Let me see if I get this right. So we had She Blinded Me with Science, You Make My Dreams Come True, Poco's Crazy Love, and Herb Albert's Rise. And I could just imagine you going like, am I going to get off the bench anytime soon? This is the climax of the movie and I got nothing to do.
You know, part of what being a composer is, and just like any collaborator on a film is be willing to experiment. So I'll tell you this, I scored the end of the movie about eight different ways, you know, and I did it all with a smile, happily working through it and finding different ways to try different musical things, until finally, you know, Joe said, you know, I think I want to try a song here. And, it was driven by this idea, like Joe had this idea that during the fight, the phone was going to like crack open. And obviously that's in the script, that it was going to crack open and like cause all these issues with the drugs. Well, Abnesi's playing all his music through the phone. Like, how cool would it be if like all of a sudden the songs go into like this crazy mode where like the music keeps on like shuffling. So I think, you know, that's a thing as a creator, as a collaborator, as someone who just wants to see a film like be amazing and be as successful and connect to the audience as much as possible. When that came about, I said, cool, like no problem. You know, and it wasn't because I didn't write all this music. I had written probably, you know, I could release like a 30-minute, you know, LP or something of all the music that isn't in the film, but you know, that's okay. That's part of the process. In fact, I often say, you know, so many movies I work on are like about 110 minutes long, and I always wind up writing 150 minutes of music. That's just the way it is. And that's just the nature of the types of films I work on usually.
Well, that also recalls, I was talking to Don Davis about his experience on The Matrix. And before they licensed that Rage Against the Machine track at the end of, as it rolled into the credits, Don Davis had to write music for whether or not there would be a song. So I figured that was the case. I was just having a little fun with you, but.
Oh, please. No, I love it. And it is a great question, a great subject to talk about, because song and score, you know, you can be at odds with each other if you're not approaching it with a story driven mindset, if it's like an ego driven thing, or if it's like a, you know, who's going to win this battle. I mean, it was never about that. It was like, hey, like, how do we tell this story in the right way possible? You know, and I think the songs going crazy and going into this crazy shuffle is like a great analogy for, you know, what's happening to Amnesty's brain at that moment. It's pretty cool. Sorry, a little bit of spoilers here, but hopefully everyone's seen it by now.
But it is also very meta, because I think that if you didn't have fun with it, it might have just been a little too, you know, there's sometimes being serious for serious sake kind of takes you out of the movie. But I don't know, those four tracks in succession just really, it's not what you expect. And I think that that's what's great about Joe, and his ability as a director to give you what you don't expect, you know, visually stimulating, musically stimulating. So all the choices come together.
He sure keeps you on your toes. I think the other thing too is like, it's levity. Yes. It brings something to it, but I think also like the songs, what's funny about the songs is like, it kind of creeps you out because you're like, this music is so happy and we're in a prison. Like, what is happening? Like, this guy is insane.
Yeah.
And so it kind of, you know, on the outside, the way, you know, Chris is playing Amnestia in a certain way, he's like very approachable. He's your friend. He's cool. He's a bro. And then he's playing you this music as he drugs you. It's like, it's, you know, put that in your pipe and smoke on it. You know, yeah. that is wacky shit. You know? So pretty cool.
So maybe what I'll do is I'll retract what I said about before, how he went source music crazy, like since he didn't get to do that for the Top Gun sequel. But in a way, he made his own version of American Psycho, because you're right. There was like Huey Lewis and Phil Collins and all those audio visual counterpoints. You know, someone's about to get axed literally, and then you're dancing to Huey Lewis. But
you're right. Like it's like the most dark points in the film. You're going to the lightest music. You know. So anyway, sorry, I cut you off.
Next no, that's question. Fine. No, but what I really noticed about the film is that there were some true key moments that really made me stand up, and I think that they were so important to the story because they unveiled things at a certain point. There's like the fallout from Heather's death, where Lizzie and Jeff are in the green room after Lizzie had her darken flocks. And those lights are, those notes are very light and airy, and then they bleed into some real heavy electronics and those dark cellos when you learn what really happened to Jeff. So when you were talking about before about blending those two together, I guess, can you tell us more about how that came to be? And
absolutely. You know, like that, I'm super honored that you picked up on that, because that sequence is one of my favorite sequences in the whole film, because it really was a case of true collaboration between there was like one giant piece of music I'd written that kind of did what that scene does, where it kind of starts in this kind of emotional, like kind of light area, and then goes to this really dark place. But then it wasn't quite emotional enough, and it wasn't quite dark enough. So like, between the editor, my music editor, and me, like we mashed up some other stuff I had written. And then I took that back in and really like dialed it in. And I spent like at least 2 or 3 days really building this really cool handoff. And then again, another shout out to Brian and the editor, my music editor, Brian Lawson, and the editor, Sierra Mirioni. We're also dealing with Metallica at that moment too, that's playing in the car. So, you know, like, you know, it became this like symphony of sound that is obviously needs room for dialogue, needs room for emotion, needs room for the audience to realize the gravity of what's happening. So I'm really proud of that moment, because I worked super hard, in addition to the whole team, and Joe obviously worked super hard on like crafting this moment that pulls you into Jeff's, you know, nightmares, like where he is, this is what haunts him. This is why he's here. He's searching for a way to redeem himself. And Lizzie is kind of his chance at redemption, like saving her and helping her is like his chance at redemption. And so everything kind of turns on this sequence, like our audience, like understanding what is in it for Jeff, why he's here, what he's lost, you know, why he's in the situation he's in. And also like, you know, what's driving him to this emotional place. So anyway, that scene was perhaps, I think, dare I say, like the most important scene ultimately for me, of like really balancing the elements. And I think at the point where we were putting the finishing on touches on that, like we had realized the ending was going to be really song driven. So this was really between that, as well as the sequence where Jeff and Mark have kind of a showdown. Those are really the two kind of spots where we really, are leaning on the score to help guide the audience. Obviously, in addition to the amazing performances of the actors, but when we're crossing time, we're crossing boundaries of you know, flashbacks and deep emotional drama. And then finally at the end of the scene, you know, when we're back in the present, and that is yet another crossover point where I think we went really unexpected, where it's really just this like 808 style drum and me playing my my home Steinway piano, but like massively filtered and transposed into different keys. So it becomes this like otherworldly emotional scene. So anyway, I could keep talking and talking about that scene. Obviously it's really important to me, but I'm really, really proud of that. And I'm really honored that you picked up on that. That's really great listening. Cause that was not an easy sequence to work on.
Well, it is noteworthy, phenomenal. And so, yeah, it deserves to be talked about. So, thank you for putting it out in the world. So its consumers can chomp on it. Even in a digital marketplace, I'm excited to hear that there's a vinyl coming out, which is a little unexpected for a Netflix release.
Unexpected. I have zero expectations for anything beyond like just hoping I keep the job and deliver the music and the movie comes out. Like that's the goal. I've worked on films that never come out. So there's never a guarantee of anything. So yes, I'm waiting for the next round of artwork to check out. You know, vinyl's always backed up for, you know, months and months and months. But in the meantime, like I'm really proud of the Prisoners of the Ghostland vinyl is like one of the most beautiful vinyl packages I've ever seen. I'm obviously proud of the music, but when I got the preview of like what the art was going to be like, I kind of fell on the floor. Like I'm proud of all my vinyl has had, like, it's amazing that my music is released much more so on vinyl, but yeah, Prisoners of the Ghostland is really special. So get that in the meantime. And then hopefully Spiderhead will be available either end of year or maybe early next or I don't know, maybe it's tomorrow. I have no idea how any of this works. So I'm the last to know.
And Prisoners of Ghostland, that's released by Waxwork Records, correct?
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
That's just it's stunning just to look at. So
it is. It really is. They just knocked it out of the park. I was just absolutely blown away. I mean, I expect great work from these companies, whether it's Waxworks or Mondo, because like you look at their websites and their releases, and I'm lucky to own some of their releases. They're all just gorgeous pieces of art to look at, you know, and then obviously listen to. But then to see that for Prisoners of the Ghostland, I was just floored. So, so exciting. Yeah.
Well, let's dive just a little bit back into how you do the magic you do. There's a scene after we learn about what happens to Jeff, where Jeff confronts Mark about the lies that Dr.
Abnesty. All good.
So the most like it's like real fast beeps. So is that called an allegro? It's just like what is that, and how did you come up with that?
You know what? I don't know if I'd even. It's funny. My composition teacher in school, I would write American words like, so instead of allegro, I'd write fast. You know, like I'm an American composer. And he looked at me, he said, like, I get what you're trying to do, but like in China, they don't understand fast, but they understand allegro. You know, it's like, oh, you know, there's something true, you know, that's classical Western music. Everyone knows what allegro means, you know? So I was like, so I rethought everything after that. But what would I call that piece of music? You know, I would call, you know, I would talk in terms probably of like individual musical elements of that, like of that piece is based around an ostinato, meaning like this repetitive, usually arpeggio, you know, type of figure. So like those clarinets kind of, you know, like we had six bass clarinets and I wrote the music. This is one of the, you know, as I get older and do more and more work, I unfortunately get to orchestrate less and less of my music. Like I have an amazing set of orchestrators I work with that I love that I hand my music off to, but Spiderhead, I was actually able to orchestrate every note myself because it just worked out schedule wise where it was, I think over Christmas break, I orchestrated most of it just myself while I was out taking a break with my family. So it was really lovely. So I know that score every note because what I did. So when I'm mocking up the piece of music, I just have like the bass clarinet patch that I'm just going, you know, incessantly on without any breaks thinking, okay, well, I'll figure it out later how they're going to breathe, you know? And so, you know, I wrote it out. So these six clarinets, like this arpeggio, this ostinato is cascading throughout the group. And so like, you know, they'll have room to breathe and kind of it's dovetailing around the ensemble. So a bunch of musical phrases to throw at you for the non-casual listeners, for the listeners who are really into like all the complex music stuff. But that was the most basic level. It's like, that is the gears turning. That is Abnesty's plan being unveiled. You know, we kind of
the bass clarinet started to really, once we got into the score and got into scoring the film, we had discussed, yeah, these bass clarinets are kind of like Amnesi's plan, you know, so that's his plan being revealed, as well as then like some of Jeff's kind of more emotional chords, like kind of appearing and floating on top of it. So that was like at the most basic raw level, those are the two things happening. And then you have this very distant choir kind of, you know, I'm kind of assigning emotion to it after the fact. I'm much more, in the moment when I'm writing that cue was written to picture, but with elements I had written previously in like the suites and the ideas I'd written for the film before I even saw a cut of the film, I was just kind of writing ideas. So it's all based on those ideas, but that cue was composed to picture. And I think what those voices represent are kind of like these pained souls in the spider head, you know, like in the distance being tortured, maybe. I don't know. Again, like in the moment, I'm not necessarily thinking of that exactly. I'm more kind of intuitively feeling it out. But that is the basic construction of that piece of music. Abnasi's plan being revealed, as well as Jeff's like kind of emotional intensity kind of bubbling up to a head there.
Well, and similarly, I'm glad you touched on the choral work, because that's, I'm wondering, is you worked with the London Contemporary Orchestra on this. And so, you know, I like what you said about the choral representing the people or the prisoners in Spiderhead, but do you tend to lean on vocal work when you have a small palette or when your fee is limited or constrained, or is it really just based on how it serves the purpose of the story? Because I really liked how anguished they were and how haunting it was at times, because it, you know, it's a prison, so everybody is in pain.
You know, with voices, you know, they're, I kind of group voices like I do with songs in the sense that it's a cheat code to emotionality. You know, we hear a solo cello, we hear a human voice, we hear a song we grew up with, nostalgia, and we are instantly transported. So when I think of music, whether it's score or songs, I feel it's like the cheapest way into someone's psyche. You know, like you could have a scene going and like the actors are acting the heck out of it and you've shot the shit out of it, you know, it looks amazing and, you know, the actors are performing so well, but, you know, you're never going to get to the emotion than if you put in like the song the audience was hearing when they were 13 years old, you know, like that is like, wow, that is emotion. So when people say, oh yeah, Beatles songs are really expensive, they're like $1 million to license, I'm like, that is a deal, like that, like pay $1 million to immediately manipulate the audience's emotion. So anyway, back to something relevant, back to Spiderhead. I think, you know, obviously for the deep emotional pain of Jeff, I think the choir was like a really great cheat code, so to speak, of like really getting into people's hearts. But I think also the idea of human emotion, the idea of human manipulation. That's why I worked with, so you mentioned London Contemporary Orchestra, who is amazing. I never worked with them before. I just knew them. I knew some of the musicians. I knew the conductor, and it was just awesome finally working with them. They did great work. And then the choir is actually a choir I've been working with now for a couple of years, called Tonality, that's based here in LA. And what's awesome about this group is like they kind of cast a wide net for singers. Every year they do auditions and kind of have a revised lineup of like the best of the best singers from around LA. And they're mostly young, they're from all sorts of backgrounds. So a lot of them classically trained, but they could do anything. So like, you know, Alexander Blake, who's the director of the choirs, has become a dear friend of mine. And so I knew when I needed the choir to go from like, you know, kind of these classic choral moments all the way to like really intimate, close mic, kind of like poppy forward sound that we're going to later really edit and tune and do this crazy stuff to, I knew that they could do anything. So we really lucked out, because we, you know, talking about budgets, you know, your budget's never unlimited. And honestly, you know, voices, especially if it's a SAG thing, because voices are covered by SAG in LA, the actors union. Voices are like super expensive. I think the voice is probably more expensive than like the cellos, you know?
And you have to pay them for the day, I think. That's one of the limiting
factors. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. So even if you need them, like, oh, I just need 1 hour with singers, like, you have to pay them for, like, a full day, because it's exactly the same with actors. You're exactly right. So you know, we spent a lot of money on singers, but rightfully so. And we didn't have, like, a whole week. We only had really 2 days, one day with adult choir and one day with children's choir. So in that one day with adult choir, we went, like, the whole gamut. Like, we started off with, like, some choral stuff. Then we went to, like, the more intimate chamber voices. Then we went back to choir. And then I said, okay, we need to do a bunch of humming, you know, and now we need to do this thing where I have an 8-way divisi of singers that is, like, looping that we need to do, like, figure out how to loop this thing over the course of the whole piece. So, you know, and they were up for the task, because that group, they're really just kind of ready for anything. They'll do Bach chorales or Bach cantatas, and then they'll sing with the Kronos Quartet, and then they'll sing with Bjork. You know, they do really amazing, amazing, amazing work. So, you know, they really chewed this up and did something great. So, yeah, really proud of, between them and the London Contemporary Orchestra. I mean, this is a score I'm really proud of how it sounds.
Well, I'm going to give you some golf claps for that. Well, two last questions for you. So, you know, usually when you work hard and you make a name for yourself, people stand up and take notice. I noticed something funny. The Herb Alpert's Rise is playing through the end credits, which I don't know who selected the font on the credits, but that was a little difficult to read. But as soon as your name came up on the credits, the music stopped and your music came in. So it's like, how did you pull that off? Like, okay, you know, everybody, Joe's on the screen.
So I wish I could make decisions like that. I think that comes down to, like, I'm speaking this off the cuff, so I don't know. I think the sound team and the music editor and the filmmakers, they like me. So, like, they were okay with my music editor doing that. My music editor is the one who's making the cuts, you know, and, like, lighting up all the final stuff, especially when it comes to end credits. You know, I'm already dealing with the whole rest of the film. I'm like, Brian, deal with the end credits. I don't, you know, whatever Joe needs, whatever Joe Kaczynski needs, like, let's just do it. And so the other thing is, though, I have a feeling that that's completely coincidental, because the working version of the film never has the final version of the credits. It's always like TBD, TBD, you know, like, they just have a rough scroll. So I highly doubt we were able to truly time that, you know? So kudos to the team if they timed it. Thank you, everyone. I had nothing to do with it, but, you know, I'm sure they saw it and said, ah, we're okay with that. Joe's a cool guy, so we'll let it happen. But yeah, no, not me, unfortunately.
Well, let's end this with a little bit of on the nose, something that relates to the movie. So G46 is a powerful drug in the movie that makes you laugh through pretty much anything. So I'm sure to get where you are, you've had a lot of adverse and difficult experiences, whether musically or sonically, whatever it is. So what point in your career would you have liked to have a little G46 just to get through a tough week of school?
Oh, my goodness. You know, Greatest Showman was like 4 years of my life, and it was an amazing, amazing project. And it came and went over the course of 4 years. And there were a lot of cooks in that kitchen, and it was really difficult. It was a really difficult one. And I'm really proud of how it turned out. I think the songs are gangbusters. I love Michael Gracie, that filmmaker is such a visionary, amazing filmmaker. I think he might want some G46 too, though, because it's a lot of cooks in the kitchen, a lot of execs, a lot of producers, a lot of, you know, song producers involved. And, you know, I think, you know, the thing I talk about often is, it's a miracle when I get a project, because I have a lot of friends who work in development and production, and, you know, they're inevitably working on anywhere from 10 to 100 projects in their portfolio of, like, you know, I have a screenwriter working on this. I bought this pitch from a writer. I bought the rights to this book. You know, I have this going into production. I have this in post-production. You know, for every one project that goes into production, you know, they're going to have at least 10 projects that never go into production, that will never see the light of day. You know, production hell, we call it, you know, a development hell or whatever. You know, so by the time you're going, hey, we need to hire Joe, first of all, it means, like, you made the damn film. Like, that's a, you know, 10% is probably generous. It's probably more of a 5 to 10% chance of a project actually getting made once it's actually engaged with and picked up. So first of all, that's a miracle. But then second of all, when I get brought into something, there's usually a team of people who've been working on something for a decade sometimes, you know, like, for instance, one of our incredible producers on Spiderhead, Jeremy Steckler, he bought the rights to the short story probably 5 to 8 years ago, something like that. And he's been trying to get Spiderhead made ever since. And so by the time you get to Joe Trapanese, and you know, the end of 2020 is when I came on, you know, you've spent 5 years developing this. So you're like just handing me this thing to like throw music on. I think Quentin Tarantino has this great quote about why he doesn't work with composers. And he goes, yeah, like, you know, you're going to work on this thing, craft this thing for years, and some guy's just going to throw music on it and like treat it like, you know, treat it like any other a day at the office. No, like that's ridiculous. So I think I lament with Quentin, and I try to think of myself as like, I'm going to do the opposite of that. I'm going to say, yes, you've handed me this baby, and I'm going to take really phenomenal care about it. So full circle, I tried to do that with Greatest Showman, but it was difficult. There's a lot of cooks. There's a lot of people poking and prodding at the baby and like trying to rip it out of your hands and like, you know, say, oh, you know, your kid should do this. Your kid should do that. This is how you're a parent. This is how you do that, you know? And so it was really an interesting one where ultimately at the end, I got brought back in to work with John Debney, who's incredible. We had a smashing time together. He's a lovely human being, obviously an amazing composer. So he's one of the few people I'd sit down with any day and like take G46 with just to enjoy. He's a really great human being, and we had a great time, but it was difficult. It was a really difficult one. And I don't think it was anyone's fault that it was difficult. It was just the nature of dealing with a very complicated project with a lot of moving pieces, a lot of cooks in the kitchen. So give me some of that G46 and take me back to, you know, 2017 or whenever that was.
I almost like to think that, you know, John Debney's a friend of the site. I've spoken to him a number of times, and he is, it seems like he's got G46 in his blood. He's a very cool character, and he's very,
I'll tell you one great story. Yeah. Like John is an inspiration because of that. He is cool as a cucumber, no matter what. And there was one instance where I knew things were bad when I was conducting at the podium, and we come to a 10-minute break, and John kind of quickly runs out of the control room to intercept me before I get in the control room and say, hey, Joe, there's some interesting debate happening. Nothing to worry about. There's just some interesting conversations happening in the control room. You know, just wanted to give you a heads up. You know, all good. And so I get in there, and it's like full meltdown mode, and like nobody knows what's going on, and they're questioning why I'm even hired on the project. You know, it's like just a disaster, you know. And John, you know, to have John there, I don't think I could have made it through with it. You know, John was hired towards the end, and I was hired towards the beginning, but I don't think I would have been able to finish that project without John Debney, you know, because he was really just like such a steadying the ship and keeping us on track. Man, what an adventure. Anyway, I'm so proud of that one. I think Pasek and Paul are two of the most brilliant people to ever touch songwriting. You know, they're amazing to work with and amazing human beings. And so it's, you know, it's just a wonderful moment in time of storm clouds or something. I have no idea what it was, but yeah, give me some G46. Give me and John Debney in the room. We'll do this, an interview together for you anytime. This is awesome.
Excellent. Well, you know, I really love the song at the end of Oblivion, and you need to help me out a little bit here, Mr. Trapanese. The last track on the Spiderhead soundtrack is called Redemption, and I couldn't place it anywhere in the movie. So, was that supposed to be a song? I mean, it feels like a banger. It's just missing some vocals. So,
well, that's one of the classic tracks. That's one of those tracks I hinted at that, you know, I was trying to score one part of the movie and didn't make it into the movie. So, you know, it's on the soundtrack. And, you know, in fact, the first track on the soundtrack isn't in the film either, acknowledged, but that was the first piece I'd written after reading the short story in the script. I wrote this piece of music, and everything from the film kind of flows from that piece of music. All the themes kind of sprout from it. So that's really the seed. So I wanted to record it. I wanted to put it on the album so that people, you know, hear like the originator, the progeny, the first piece of the idea, and then listen from there to the score. And so, you know, I think that's one of the coolest things about being a film composer is that, you know, you kind of can escape the film sometimes. You go, obviously I'm like super proud of Spiderhead. It's one of the coolest films I've ever been associated with, if not the coolest, and working with Joe again was amazing. But I also think it's cool that like you get to have this thing that you take away from the film, which is the soundtrack, and you get to like get more into the story through the soundtrack. I've always said that to people, like, how cool is it that we as film composers we're like kind of the only thing that you could take away from the movie, like after leaving the theater, so to speak. You know, like you could drive around with the soundtrack playing, you could play the soundtrack at home while you're eating dinner and think more about the movie and remember like, oh, how cool is that scene as you're hearing, you know, the music. Like it's really kind of, it's kind of magic. I feel like a wizard sometimes. So yeah, I look forward to coming back again to revealing more wizardly things perhaps in the future.
Excellent. Well, Joe, I know you're a very busy man, so I'll let you get back to your very busy schedule. Why don't you just take us out really quickly? Are you working on something that you can share?
Absolutely. I'm a very busy man. I have Shadow and Bone and Witcher coming back, which is awesome. I'm really proud of both those series. They are so different, but they're both obviously Netflix fantasy shows. So I'm really grateful to be a part of the Netflix family between that and Spiderhead. You know, I have my bases covered at Netflix, which is really fun. I'm really proud of that work. And I'm telling my mom to get Netflix. My mom is always like, when can I see your work in the theater? And like, mom, I'm sorry, you're just gonna have to download Netflix, please, you know? So anyway, I'll leave you guys with that. I'm really proud of the music I've been working on for those forthcoming seasons. So excited to share those when I can.
Excellent. Good buddy. Good conversation. Good times with you, Mr. Trapanese. We will catch you next time.
Call me Joe. Anytime. Anytime.